Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Nunes is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons. Dan?
Sorry, I had my mic on mute right off the bat.
So yeah, now. Strong start.
As I was saying to myself, we don't have to play Lamar Jackson for another 12 months week.
Is he a redshirt sophomore, or is he a true sophomore?
I believe he is a true sophomore.
Damn it.
Yep.
Damn it. I don't want to face him ever again.
We're going to, unless there's strange divisional realignment that doesn't require us to play Louisville in the next year, which is not really...
likely at all.
Feasible.
No. so that sucks. We'll start off with the bad, and then we'll work our way to the good, I promise. Last week, Syracuse lost 62-28. It could have been worse, but after the rewatch, I would also say it could have been better as well, if that makes any sense.
I think it goes on both ends. It would have been nice if the offense didn't get totally shut down in the second half for the most part. I think there were, like, encouraging moments. It's hard to be, like, too, you know, rosy about a 62-28 loss. But I think I said on Twitter the day after, trying to internalize everything, like, I still think that last year, you know, maybe Syracuse doesn't give up 62 points, but they probably don't score 28, and it's probably just as bad, if not worse. So, I mean, I'd rather lose a somewhat exciting, fairly high-scoring game than lose, you know, 35-0 and just look totally anemic on both ends of the ball rather than just one. But I thought this game kind of outlined, like, it was kind of the worst case scenario for on defense, I guess. But it also just kind of shows what the issue Syracuse has, what we've been talking about. Louisville has some crazy talent, especially, you know, Lamar Jackson has played himself from, like, oh, maybe he'll be, you know, it was kind of like, I feel like going into the season, he was like, we don't want to say name the same guys as Heisman possibility, so we're just going to throw him in there because he looked really good a couple times down the stretch. And he's, like, legitimately, I think he's 6-1 now in the Heisman, which is crazy. He's, like, a favorite at this point, which is nuts, and we'll see what happens this weekend. But there's a big gap in terms of talent on both these rosters, especially with him on the field. There's a huge issue in terms of players being out of position, and it's no one on the team's fault, really. There was a big shift in philosophy, and there was some large scale issues in recruiting and keeping players on the roster that Nate Mink wrote a really good piece about today on Syracuse.com, which you should all read. It's very informative. And basically, a lot of these things all mesh together, and it's created a pretty tough situation on that side of the ball for Dino Babers in year one. And rather than, you know, bemoaning it or saying we were better off with the old staff, which is crazy, you know, just kind of understand where we're at. And hopefully, you know, in the next year or two, those issues will start to melt away. And we can kind of enjoy the good things that are coming of this year, particularly on the offensive side.
No, completely. And I think you nailed a lot of that on the head there. You know, last year, maybe it would have been a little bit closer. Or at least with last year's staff, it would have been a little bit closer, but I don't know if the margin would have been much closer. I'd rather lose by 34, scoring 28 against a top 15 team, than losing by 34 and scoring 10. There was nothing entertaining about last year's games. Even in wins, it was kind of grasping at straws to really find something, you know, truly, whether it was watchable or interesting. This year, there's takeaways, there's you know, teaching moments, there's abilities to learn and get better. I think you're right, Mink's piece does a great job of really pointing out kind of how we got here. The fact of the matter is that while the old staff was a little defensively minded, it was also filled with a lot of guys who were probably underqualified for a Power 5 job. I feel like Schaefer was a much better coordinator. And that's not new information to anyone. I think that's followed the blog, knows either of us. I think a lot of SU fans are kind of in that same boat. Technique was not emphasized for the old group, and now when you're adding in a lack of baseline technique to go with a lack of depth and a lack of familiarity in this new system. It all kind of comes to a head in what we saw, which was, you know, wide open plays. It wasn't even as embarrassing as last year's Florida State game, because, you know, that was actually a group that, while young, was playing the scheme it was designed to play. It was getting hands on guys, but just bouncing off them. In this case, I felt like, you know, we just kind of ended up watching a team that couldn't even get a hand on the guys, and it wasn't just Lamar Jackson. It was kind of, you know, every receiver, every running back. The team's just not prepared to compete at that level. I think most of that goes in the old coaching staff. I think, and I mentioned this on Twitter after the game, there's some things to say about the current coaching staff that you might want to address, and that's just, like, I don't think any P5 school should look like that on defense, no matter the situation. You should have the athletes, but I think by and large, this does not rest on Dino Babers' shoulders. It doesn't rest on Nick Monroe. It doesn't rest on anybody on the defensive side of the ball, as much as it might, you know, a lot of the factors that, again, Mink laid out on Syracuse.com.
Yeah, and I, you know, not saying that it's like excusable or anything, but I actually got a tweet, I think, during my tweet storm following the game, where someone said, you know, like, this tackling was awful, and it was. It was, the tackling was really bad. The tackling wasn't a strength under Schaefer. Schaefer's defense has had some strengths, especially when he was the coordinator. Tackling was not one of them.
No.
Never was. And I'm not saying that to be, like, an asshole about the Schaefer regime. It just, like, that team, it flew around, it was fast, it blitzed a lot. Was not a sure tackling squad very often. And somehow it was a better tackling squad than the Dread Robinson teams. So, you know, go figure that one out. But anyway, I think in like a year or two, once we actually get some players in here, once those numbers that are outlined in the Nate and the Mink piece, and I honestly didn't even realize how dire the depth situation was. Obviously, you know, it's pretty apparent when you watch the team, but I didn't realize just how low those numbers are. Once that gets addressed through recruiting and you're bringing in guys who fit the system, who are, you know, physically the right pieces, and you're not playing like linebackers at defensive end on certain plays and stuff like that, and you're hopefully going to have like a full complement of players in the secondary. And in that piece that we keep on referring to, he really lays out the secondary has probably been hit hardest of anything, just in terms of guys who, like, really promising players who don't end up making it to campus at all. Yeah, I mean, I think in a year or two, we can start griping about the defensive coaching staff. Right now, it's really hard to know what's on them. Obviously, tackling, you know, you can coach that up and help that no matter, like, what, you know, year it is or what the situation is. But I'm going to struggle to really have a schematic gripe until, you know, a year or two from now, when these guys have proven that they can bring in their own players and kind of have the guys that they no fit their system, versus like what is kind of a mash unit at this point in terms of schematic fit and you know, guys playing probably before their time and guys playing way out of position. So we'll see what happens. If anything, I think you can make the Syracuse season a little more enjoyable by betting a lot of overs, because I think we're going to hit the vast majority of them this year.
I think you're completely right. I think that the end of the line started at 66 on this coming weekend's game and has already moved up to 72.5 as of the other day. I don't even know if that's high enough, admittedly. But yeah, I think you bet the over until proven otherwise with this SU team. They're not really going to take their foot off the gas, and opponents, because of that, aren't going to take theirs off either. As we saw last week with Lamar Jackson, and Bobby Petrino also seemed like he had a little bit of an axe to grind with SU a little bit. You know, I think people need to remember, and this goes back to what Sean's piece was saying and what you were saying earlier, is that, you know, Babers told us beforehand that this was going to be a process. This was going to be a 1.5, a 2-year thing, and we had to have some patience and wait it out a little bit. You know, we were kind of deluded into thinking, because of, you know, a 10-point loss to Clemson and a 10-point loss to LSU, that for some reason we were not in dire straits, and that Schaefer's strategies, not all of them, but some of Schaefer's strategies really did, you know, do some harm and put us back to depths that we hadn't seen since before Marone. People convinced themselves that that wasn't the case, and you're seeing it broad as day that this is exactly what happened. No, we didn't reach the pure depths of the Robinson era, but I wouldn't say we were that far off. And thankfully, SU's administration made the move to go a different direction. Otherwise, yeah, for all we know, maybe we march through another 4-8 campaign this year. Sure, but it's probably not an entertaining one. It's not one that really excites a fan base, excites anyone, the national media, excites recruits about our prospects long term.
Right, and I'm willing to. I honestly still think, like, with all the structural issues this team has, it's probably going to be just as it's it, at worst. I bet it's not going to be any worse than it would have been under Schaefer. Maybe you could argue that, like, Schaefer would have found a way to, like, win a weird game by, like,
when did he ever prove that?
Okay, that's very fair. Yeah, this it'll probably be a better season no matter what. thanks for just kicking out any possibility of that. So hopefully and now I know after we're all trying to preach perspective here, if we beat South Florida, people are gonna lose their minds, right? Like, oh, just, so Louisville's the best team in the country, so Syracuse still gonna win 8 games.
Yeah, obviously. Yeah, because if SU beats USF and Louisville beats Florida State, there's going to be a thread somewhere on the internet that goes, we can beat Florida State, here's how.
I don't know what the how is. Like, voodoo dolls, maybe some soap carvings.
Step one, put illegal paraphernalia into backpacks. Step two, call police. Step three.
Or, illegal paraphernalia can just be pencils and call the NCAA. Charleston Southern's revenge.
Oh, God. So, I guess looking back, because we're going to talk about the Louisville game a little bit more before we move on to USF. Dan, what was the most startling statistic for you on Louisville's end? In a game full of them, obviously they put up one of the more impressive offensive performances in recent memory against Syracuse or any other opponent. They were knocking on the door of 1,000 yards. I'd say that they were actually knocking on the door of 80 plus points if they hadn't dropped 10 passes. But what was most startling and maybe scary for you as a Syracuse fan?
I think it might have been, like you said, with all those drops, like Louisville's receivers, when they weren't running directly by Syracuse DBs, like, they really didn't have a great game. They dropped a lot of very catchable balls. I'd argue that a lot of the biggest Syracuse defensive stops were because of drops and not really because of anything SU's players did. So this one could have really been out of hand. And the fact that we were actually in the game into the third quarter is kind of remarkable based on how it ended up playing out. But, There's definitely a talent gap here. Petrino's done a nice job in kind of picking where Charlie Strong left Louisville, and I don't know that he's, if he hasn't reached the same heights, he's, has him on a really nice trajectory. But everything that, I fear that the Florida State game, when that comes around, or even the Notre Dame and Clemson games, depending on if Clemson, decides to join the college football season this year.
Nope.
Just could get really ugly, because those teams on paper are all more talented. Two of them, I would say, all three of them have quarterbacks that, they haven't done what Lamar Jackson's done this year. Obviously, competition is a factor there, but they're all very capable. You might have the two best quarterbacks in the country in Deshaun Kizer and Deshaun Watson. And then DeAndre Francois isn't exactly, slouch either. So, I think we said this in an earlier podcast before the year, like, a couple of these games are probably going to get pretty ugly. So just be ready, everyone. this year, we're going to take our lumps this year for sure. There might go up 60 points a few more times. And honestly, I actually really appreciated the piece that Bud Poliquin wrote today. He gets like one a year where he really nails something, which is, which is nice. Nice, he delivers one into the right field seats every so often, but, you know, he bats about 150 otherwise.
Yeah, he's Ray Ordonez.
he plays a really good shortstop. Bud just cleans up on in the field, and his D-war is out of control. he comes in the ninth, and you know he comes in with a closer. No, he wrote a really, really good piece today, all joking aside, and it was just like a really good way to keep perspective, and his basic thing was like, none of these games, like the result of these games this year really don't matter much because odds are Syracuse, you know, based on what we saw this week, you know, they're probably not going to go bowling. Even if they do go bowling, it's going to be, you know, the Heart of Dallas Bowl or something. And it's way more about, you know, just the development of this program and setting up the 2018, 2019, 2020 Orange to be really competitive, solid teams. And what happens this year against Florida State is kind of inconsequential. And I get why a Syracuse fan, it's hard to swallow that, because that's been kind of the reality for so long. But if you remember back to, like, the 09 team, the first Maroon team, that team was kind of on the verge of a bowl based on a couple of really close losses. And obviously the fact that they didn't make one was depressing at the time. But, like, I have some really fond memories of that year just because it was so much better than the 08 team, my freshman year.
It was a fun team. I mean,
it was a fun team.
We had Greg Paul as a quarterback, and we almost made a bowl game.
Yeah, and it's obviously not the same as this team, but they had a really good D. Maybe the best D Maroon had there, honestly.
Yeah.
I mean, 2010 was close. But 2009, I think they might have been, like, a better playmaking unit. They had an awesome linebacking core. They had some nice corners. Like, that defense was really fun. The offense was lagging way behind. Paulus was, like, still his Syracuse year is one of the more interesting ones I can remember, because I think, we've talked about this on the site, like, a lot over the last couple of years, but I still think he almost, I don't want to say underrated, but I think his year is very much shaded by the fact that Ryan Nassib came after him, and also that South Florida game where, like, half of his interceptions came from, which was just a disastrous performance. But overall, like, I have very fond memories of that team, and this team obviously is much different in terms of playing style and how they compete, but I feel like in, like, 3 or 4 years, we might feel the same thing, and this team might only go 4-8 or 5-7. But I think, you know, we'll be like, you know, you could tell something good was happening, and obviously they lost, you know, a couple really awful games, and they got blown out a few times, but, like, that was the start of something, and even if they don't make a bowl, I think there is value in that. So trying to enjoy the process here, and if you can think back to, like, that Maroon year, obviously not everyone was thrilled at the time, but if it brings to, like, brighter days down the road, I think it will be something that we'll find worthwhile.
Yeah, and I mean, you know what? This is the weird thing about sports is that, you know, a lot of things in life you're willing to invest in the future. Cars, relationships, houses, education, your job. Like, all of these things are hedging toward long-term success. And yet when it comes to sports, most fans, especially for some reason Syracuse football fans who have no reason to be optimistic on a year-to-year basis anyway, we have no ability as fans to view a process as a multi-year thing, as a slow build, as something that you have to look at, you know, the full picture over the individual game results. I mean, this is going to be a team, and SU fans aren't used to this because it's never happened before. This is going to be an SU team that reminds you of, like, when Texas Tech goes 4-8, or when Washington State went, like, 3-9 for a couple of years. Like, you're not going to be able to stop anyone. You're going to still be able to score between 28 and 35 points a game, even against good teams. It's at some point the wheels are going to fall off in the game, and you're going to lose because of the talent gap and because you're not ready for the scheme. All of these things are things Babers said beforehand. All of these things are things you and I and many others talked about before the season started. There's no surprises. And if you go in and you adjust those expectations, and again, you could look at Texas Tech, you could look at Cal. There's a ton of other, you know, spread air raid teams that you could look at, and, you know, not to tease it out too much, but if SU does lose this week, I do have a piece in mind kind of making this kind of comparison with, you know, a bunch of spread programs around the country and how it was much easier to recruit for the offense than the defense. But once they did recruit for the defense, you saw a huge, huge
kind of surge in production on that end. Like I said, I still think we're a year and a half, 2 years away just because of the lack of horses we have on that side of the ball. But if you view it as this is going to be one of those late night Pac-12 shootouts, or this is going to be one of those random, you know, Big 12 games on Fox Sports 1 that I'm not watching for some stupid reason because I don't like points apparently, you'll be much better off than if you apply the tired old Syracuse lens to a very, very different Syracuse team.
Yeah, and that's not saying we want, like, to be a 4-8 Texas Tech team forever.
No.
But if you're going to go 4-8, again, I'd so much rather doing it playing games that are in the 80s rather than playing games that are in the 30s.
Yeah, would you rather be 4-8 Texas Tech or 4-8 Minnesota? There's a clear answer.
It's really hilarious because I was trying to think of the 4-8 team that wasn't Texas Tech, and my first thought was Minnesota. I mean, but 4-8 Minnesota, you still get the dilly bars in 30-degree weather, so there's something for everyone.
Hey, that was the 2012 Texas Bowl?
No, it was more recent than that.
No,
and
I know the bar thing was, but the matchup, the Texas Tech Minnesota game.
Oh, I don't know.
That sounds right because I remember Minnesota fans being really pissed off. They had to go back to the Texas Bowl.
Did they play two Texas Bowls?
Yeah, I thought they played in the one before us.
They did, but I don't think it was Texas Tech. So the 2012 Texas Bowl. They did play Texas Tech in the 2006 Insight Bowl, it looks like.
Hmm.
Which is definitely not something I'm thinking of. The 2010 Texas, or 2012 Texas Bowl.
Yeah, I got is the Insight Bowl. We're not going to do this for the full thing.
It was Texas Tech. Oh, it was Texas Tech Minnesota.
Yes.
And they lost both. They lost both Texas Bowls.
The photographic memory strikes again. Anyway, so that was fun. So looking a little more positively, Dan, what was the best statistic that you saw from Syracuse looking down the stat line, whether it's a team stat or whether it's an individual's stat line? What is something that you saw as a highlight and something that you'd love to see more of going forward?
Amba Edetawo is really, really, really good.
Yes. Weird. I think two people that have the Syracuse podcast have been talking about him as being the key to the offense for, I don't know, 6 months?
Yeah. I expected, you know, based on Babers being high on him and everything, I was like, oh, maybe he'll be a nice piece this year. A nice, you know, he'll get probably some open looks because he's playing opposite Steve Ishmael, who I still think we'll see some big games from. Obviously, he's entered the year with a lot of hype and a lot of focus. But Edetawo is, like, he just looks great. Great downfield threat, which is something this team needed. I'm sure he'll start drawing double teams, which should open up the rest of the offense as well. But it's really incredible what he's done. And it makes sense in context now that he's doing this well. Not that, like, he had, like, this huge Maryland career, aside from the game when he played SU and he had a really big game. But, like, Maryland's quarterback situation his whole time there was pretty ridiculously bad. And
it's been bad for about a decade now.
Yeah. And, I mean, they borderline wasted Stephon Diggs and Deion Long, and he was, like, the number three or four guy behind them. But, like, there just wasn't a guy who was going to get them the ball with any regularity. He was on that team that had, like, the linebacker playing quarterback for games.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not a real surprise that he didn't have this hugely productive tenure at Maryland, especially because he was playing behind two, like, really good receivers and with no quarterback for a lot of it. But, I mean, I think even those of us who were, you know, pretty excited to see what he would do, don't think we expected him to do this. Like, he's at the top of a lot of receiving rankings in the entire country. So that's a nice, fun subplot for the year, too, seeing how ridiculous his stat line can get for the end of the year. I mean, I would be shocked if he didn't break, like, at this point, based on what we've seen so far, like, he should be over 1,100 or 1,200 yards, for sure.
He's definitely going to, I know I mentioned this in an article on, I think it was Sunday, he's already, like, within striking distance of, he's probably, like, two games, he's about two games away from surpassing
Ishmael's numbers as last year's leading receiver.
Yeah, I mean, that just tells you all you need to know about, like, the difference between the two offenses.
Well, the difference between the two programs. Like, I don't care, even if you are winning games, like, that's not sustainable. Like, ask Boston College how that works out for them. And, like, I mean, we'll see what happens with Wake, but I think the Wolford era is over there. But, you know, just ask them how that's worked out for them the last couple of years, having leading receivers with, you know, 400 yards or so of yardage on the season. Like, it doesn't work. And eventually, like, that's going to catch up to you. Teams are going to know exactly how to play against that unless you have 4- and 5-star guys. Like, Boston College, most years until recently, was an exception to that rule in that they were able to use superior scheme to compete. And I think, you know, SU, and this kind of traces back to our point from before, SU has a very good scheme right now. It's not superior because we haven't had enough time to perfect it upon implementation. You know, so right now we're gonna lose to teams that are more talented than us, and that goes for Notre Dame, that goes for LSU next year probably. You know, it's Clemson, it's Florida State, that's obviously Louisville right now. We're going to lose those games just because we don't have the perfected offense to compete. And until the offense is perfected or at least close to it and is operating at peak efficiency, you know, that's when superior coaching and scheme can help even out a disparity in talent. So right now, you know, just looking at it from a very simple equation standpoint like that, there's a very slim chance that SU can make up that gap when it's only two games into, you know, a brand new scheme.
Right, and I actually appreciate, like, I think there are things that Syracuse could do to artificially keep those games against teams like Louisville this year, Florida State probably down the strap, down, you know, later in the year. There are things you could do to artificially make that game closer, and Babers doesn't seem willing to do that because there's no real point to it if you're not going to actually win the game. And he said, like, I'm not playing to play close, I'm playing to win. So I really appreciate that he's going to go run the offense. I kind of wish he had taken Eric Tungy out a little earlier against Louisville, but, you know.
Especially because nothing. We weren't, like, doing anything. I do want to talk about that because I brought it up on the play calling breakdown as well. Did you feel like we could have at least made up some of the respectability and maybe tried out a couple more things on offense by, like, really trying to do more in that fourth quarter? Because I feel like with 2 or 3 drives to go, I mean, we had 20 effing drives in the game, which is insane. With 2 or 3 drives to go, do you think we just kind of, like, gave up a little bit too quick?
I don't know.
I mean, yes, we still lost by 34. We would have lost no matter what. And this flies in the face of all of our arguments against playing Dungy late last year against Louisville when he got hurt. But
yeah, I'm really conflicted on it. I get wanting to, like, have your guys play against live, you know, really good teams and get more live reps. I think there is value there. I think the fact that Dungy has his concussion history where, you know, we're all pretty sure he's had 2 concussions. I think it's actually kind of just on the record now. If it wasn't for that, I would be a lot less iffy with it. But as we saw against Central Michigan last year and a lot of, you know, a bunch of other games at this point last year, it only takes, like, one hit on one freakish play. Even, and if it's in garbage time, like, I really just don't think it's worth the risk in a game where you're down 30. And, you know, there's also an argument to be made, you know, let's get Zach Mahoney some more reps just because if something does happen in a live game situation where, you know, it's a one touchdown game and Syracuse can still win it, if they're playing for, like, a 6th win or something, you know, getting your backup some reps against good competition also has value. So I don't know. I'm not going to, like, harp on it too much. And I realize that we probably sound a little hypocritical because I think we lost our minds last year in this pretty much the same situation. Obviously later in the year when it was pretty well established that we weren't going bowling. But I personally would still like to see Babers err on the side of caution in a 34-point game with your multiple-time concussion victim, Eric Dungy, playing quarterback. And as we saw in this game, Dungy is still very much Dungy in that he will try to hurdle people and, you know, send, you know, has that reckless abandon that he plays with, which we both kind of enjoy to a point and also are terrified by. Like, he he's, you know, been a little more safe this year, but he's still gonna throw his body around and try to make crazy plays because that's just the player he is. So if you can kind of save him from himself when it's not a situation in which Syracuse has a lot to gain, I think that's probably for the best. So we'll see how it goes going forward. I mean, if it happens a couple more times, I'm probably going to lose my mind. But hopefully this was like a one-time thing. Hopefully we're not losing by 34 many more times this year. But as we've said in this podcast, that is definitely on the table.
Yeah. I mean, I mentioned this in my responses to the Daily Stampede, SB Nation's USF blog. That, you know, what makes him so effective is also what makes him so terrifying as a player in a bad way. And that is he has this reckless abandon, kind of gunslingery, you know, Brett Favre for the love of the game BS that, like, I mean, he's definitely, and I always bring this up just because it's funny how the gameplay, not the off the field behavior, but how some of it, I said when we recruited him, I saw the film, I said, this kid's got a little bit of Manziel in him. And I think a lot of that is lived up in the sense that there's no play that he thinks he can't make. There's no run he won't attempt. There's no hit that he won't take to try to get a first down. And you love that about him. But you see it, how quickly he shifts gears into that when the chips are against Syracuse and when you know, the Orange are down by, I mean, in this one, 21 in the first 5 minutes or so. So he just... he embraces that too quickly, and I feel like, you know, Dino Babers hasn't broken him of it completely yet because, again, you saw how quick he was to, while he refused to sacrifice his body in the same way he did last year, for the most part, that one attempted hurdle was still, I mean, I thought, like, this is it. This is, the season's done already because he can't be smart about when and where he takes hits.
Right. And like, it's quite thrilling that he goes into this like crazy quarterback survival, like got to win the game mode. But overall in a game that was, you know, I guess when that hurdle happened, like we were still very much in it. That was when Syracuse was kind of coming back and made it close at the half. But, you know, hopefully we're in a position where the offensive line can keep him upright a little bit more and he can make more plays with his arm. Because obviously this game, he was running for his life a lot, and that's where he gets into this mode. It's just hard. It's hard to, like, criticize him for doing it because it's also probably the thing that made him as good as he is. But, you know, just in the back of your head, every time he does anytime he, like, breaks contain, honestly, I start to be like, all right, just please slide. Like, I don't care where. Just slide, Eric. Like, it's just not worth it this year.
But he has, admittedly. Other than that
play, yes, he's gotten way better, for sure.
Extremely. And you know what? I think the run, he's ran smart. I know that one, what was it, like a 10 or 12-yard first down pickup that got us inside the five. I thought that was a great play. He had another one that was really good. But yeah, unfortunately, every single time he does one of those, I still have flashbacks to, you know, the hurdle that could have gone very wrong. That ridiculous lateral he had in the Central Michigan game before he got knocked out of that one. One of the runs that he had in the Louisville game before he ended up getting knocked out of that game. The Pitt hit that really, that was definitely a third concussion. I know ESPN kind of alluded to that on the broadcast the other day. It's scary.
On the bright side, apparently, Syracuse's concussion protocol that seemed very cut and dry is no longer that cut and dry. So I guess he can just keep on doing him.
Don't commit to things that you can't commit to. Just don't commit them to words. Oh. Just don't say anything. Just leave it off the record. Say you have no like formal concussion protocol. It's on a case-by-case basis, and you leave it alone.
Which is what they're saying now, except that we heard for like 3 years that it was not that. Because we had a lot of players get forced into retirement because of that concussion protocol. And, like, those of us, I really didn't have a big problem with the concussion protocol. I was fine being more safe than sorry.
Same.
I get that things get tricky when you have a star quarterback. And I'm willing to, you know, probably naively give Syracuse the benefit of the doubt here. But, yeah, bottom line, let's hope that Eric Dungy doesn't take any more, like, awful, that especially cheap shot hits. So, yeah. And hopefully no more, like, you know, down or up 30 points and scrambling and taking shots and anything unnecessary. Let's all be safe and hope that, you know, the one official, but probably definitely two and most likely three concussions don't turn into 2, 3, 4.
I would agree. On that note, why don't we a little halftime, then we can preview the USF game.
That sounds good to me.
All right, so Dan, what have you been drinking?
Kind of a general potpourri of the normal stuff. Looking in my fridge right now, actually a decent amount of Southern Tier. We had people bring over a mixed pack of that for the fantasy draft I hosted last week. We have the Tangier, the IPA, which is very good. So a lot of the pretty standard, the two-time IPA as well. A couple of things from Coney Island, which isn't my favorite brewery here in the city, but they make some decent stuff. I think I slacked and forgot to check into them on Untappd, so just sorry to make your job a little harder, John. I know. And there's one more thing. What did we have last week? Did I talk about the... Oh, no, we did our fantasy draft, so a lot of the other, like, the other more interesting stuff we already covered. But yeah, mostly Southern Tier, honestly, was the big highlight this week, which is nice. I haven't had a lot of that recently, and that's one of my favorite breweries from up there, for sure.
Fair enough. Some stuff from me. I had a Melter Street IPA from Trillium out in Boston area. Had that sent over to me by a friend. The brewery's Doty. I think I talked about this one way back. Had it on draft, and then I had the bottle that I had in my fridge this past Friday after the game. It was a Manhattan-inspired beer. Interesting one. Had some Snuggle Bug, which I always like to push. Had a Pick Six Pilsner from Pizza Port. Pizza Port has been expanding their selection of canned beers, and the Pilsner is pretty much like a year old. I actually hadn't had it before just because I'm not really in the market for like buying Pilsners on a regular basis, but had a variety pack, figured I'd drink one. We were, you know, kind of day drinking and hanging out by the pool, so easy one to down there. Had a Modern Times Oneida Pale Ale, a little bit past its prime, but did the job. Had a Pizza Port Swami's IPA, one of my favorite IPAs around. And then I was at the Angels-Rangers game on Sunday, so I stopped over at Noble Ale Works across the street. Afterward, had a Back in the Day IPA, which is sort of loosely based on the original Stone IPA recipe from back when that brewery started. And then also another beer they had called Pina Face. It was a Pina Colada-inspired beer. It definitely wasn't too sweet, which I appreciated. Overall, it was a taster, so it really wasn't anything like amazing. But yeah, that was my week of drinking.
Very nice.
Indeed. All right. So looking now at South Florida, the Bulls, our former conference mates over in the Big East. Last year, they did terrible things to us en route to a big win. This year, they have pretty much all the same players that did those terrible things. So I'm not overly optimistic. I'm also not overly optimistic because despite not really having Marlon Mack for much of the last two games, they've still been able to rush for over 500 yards with 6 touchdowns to go with it. It seems like, you know, guys like Darius Tice and Darius Johnson are kind of able to pick up right where Mack left off. And Mack is also back against Syracuse. So yeah, I'm terrified because I can just kind of look at players on this USF roster, and while the talent level might not be at the same as Louisville, it's really not that far off. South Florida's actually been able to out-recruit a lot of Power 5 programs, us included, and hang around in that top 50 or so range, which is really where Louisville is, kind of that 35 to 45 area for the past few seasons. And you look at a guy like Quentin Flowers, who, while he's, I think, a little less accurate than Jackson, he has similar speed when he's running the ball. Maybe not the same exact. I don't want to, you know, start getting assailed by Cards fans on Twitter for the second straight week. But, yeah, he's a similar player in the sense that he can and will take off. He knows how to put the ball where it needs to go, passing, but that there are some kind of fundamental issues that, you know, just from a mechanics sense that he just doesn't have down. But he'll still kill you if you're not going to cover receivers. We saw it last year against him. We saw it last week against Jackson. You're going to leave guys wide open most
quarterbacks can probably hit that receiver. Dan, I kind of spelled out what scares me. What's scaring you right off the bat?
The fact that Dino Babers has drawn comparisons between USF and Louisville's offenses all week, and that, I mean, I know that's kind of in Babers' MO, is to, like, not... Like, he hasn't really sugarcoated anything, but and he seems to be trying to set expectations at an appropriate level, which we didn't really buy into, and now we're very much buying into. I'm looking at their advanced statistical profile page from Football Study Hall, the fine SB Nation advanced college football stat site, and the thing that jumps out at me, and it reminds me of last year's matchup, which really was a breakout game for South Florida and kind of set them up to have a very nice year and save Willie Taggart's job and make them one of the premier programs in the AAC. Their ISO points per play is sitting at 171, and that's basically a rating of how explosive the offense is. They rank 5 in the nation, and if you remember the game last year, like, explosive plays was the entire game. As soon as Syracuse, like, inched close, they'd break a 45-yard screen or a 25-yard run. So, yeah, they pick up big chunks of plays, and looking at their stats, like, there isn't, like, a glaring weakness on this team based through their first two games. Obviously, Towson is not, a great thing, a great game to base things on, but they then stomped Northern Illinois last week. Northern Illinois has been a very good team for about 6 or 7 years, so I don't know how good they're going to be this year, but the fact they lost by 31 to the South Florida team is not overly encouraging.
I think Northern Illinois is bad this year.
There's a chance of that. But nothing South Florida has done this year has made... Right. Made me feel like this is going to be a very easy game for Syracuse. The same site, Bill Connolly's numbers have it as a 54% win probability for USF, which seems low. I guess that's encouraging. Obviously, being in the dome helps. I don't think this is going to be like a huge blowout like the Louisville game at all. But South Florida is really playing really good football. They have a solid mobile quarterback, which has given Syracuse issues for the entirety of the time I've been a Syracuse fan, to be honest. Flowers is very good. Mac seems to be back at close to 100%. He's one of the better runners, probably in the group of five. And they, like you said, they have a solid assortment of talent. They're definitely not a team that's going to be dwarfed by Syracuse's talent, even despite the Power 5 to group of five drop-off at all. They're probably pretty similar levels, and USF is much more assured in their what they do, and their program is kind of clicking on some, you know, if not all cylinders, pretty close. I don't feel great about the matchup. I'm hoping it will be closer, and I'm hoping that, and I expect it to be. I don't think this is done. Lamar Jackson's not on this team, so I don't think there's anyone that's going to account for, like, 600 yards by himself. But the things that happened last year... If that does happen, then I think we have some very deep concerns about going forward. But it's not the best matchup. And when we schedule these games, we're like, oh, South Florida stinks now. This looks great. We get to go to a trip for Florida. It helps recruiting.
I did not say this.
Well, when were these games scheduled? Like 2014, 2013?
Like 2014, and I was on the hate train from day one.
Because, I believe you.
Because, A, I'm always on the hate train, and B, I saw it as, and I know you and I are pretty much in agreement on this, there's zero benefit to scheduling an American Athletic Conference team, especially one in Florida where we play every other year anyway. If you beat an AAC team, you were supposed to, no matter how good they are. If you don't, you were upset, even if you weren't. You lost to a quote-unquote inferior program, even if they aren't. There is zero benefit at all, especially for a program like Syracuse that is looking to build its resume back up, build its program back up. Putting a game like this on there makes zero goddamn sense. It didn't at the time. I hate this series more than I hated the UConn series because UConn needs a good hire and several classes to really build something. And you're seeing maybe that with Bob Diaco. I think they challenged Navy last week, but they also almost lost to Maine the week before. They finished 6-6 last year, mostly just picking up body bags. It's tough to know what UConn really is, but you know UConn can improve with quality coaching, even if it takes a couple of years. It can happen, and then you have to kind of gamble with it whether it does or not. So that series, I'm not pleased, but I can deal with it. The USF series, on the other hand,
USF, because of how they can recruit, and whether you want to believe, you know, that calling yourself South Florida instead of Central Florida or Northern Florida, whatever, you know, whether you want to believe that that helps recruiting or not, the fact of the matter is that USF can recruit at a top 50 level pretty consistently and can out-recruit most of, if not all of, the group of five, save Houston. I'd say they've done that now pretty consistently for the last 3 or 4 years. And now you're seeing this talent kind of come to roost and really show up. So again, you know, you don't need an amazing coach to turn USF into something very good, especially in the conference they're in. They should be able to bang out, you know, 5, maybe 6 conference wins a year, and then everything else from there. You know, is when you take you go from a very good G5 school to one contending for a playoff spot. One stat, I know you mentioned explosiveness from Syracuse's from USF standpoint on offense. So I wanted to bring up Syracuse's allowed explosiveness for teams on defense. And right now they are ranked 118th in terms of explosive plays allowed. This is going to get ugly.
Yeah, and obviously through 2 games, like, a lot of that's blown up by the fact that Lamar Jackson completed, 75 passes over 18 yards. So I don't know that Syracuse will be 118th in the defensive ISO PPP ranking all year. But it's just not a good – the matchup is just not great. It's just – USF has a specific strength, and it's not like – say, you know, it's also based on 2 games. Like, maybe they're not going to be the 5th most explosive team all year. But – We just saw this matchup last year, and this is exactly the thing that was the difference in what probably would have been a pretty close game last year if not for it. So based on the stats so far this year, it does look like it'll manifest itself. Similarly, I hope to be wrong. I'm not confident that I'm going to be wrong.
Yeah, I don't think you're going to be wrong either, and that's not me, like, rejoicing in that. I'm unfortunately upset about it because, yeah, this to me is the game that decides whether a bowl's within reach or not. That sounds unfair in a lot of ways. USF is probably one of the 25 to 30 best teams in the country this year, but you look at the schedule and you see the other top programs on there. USF is probably the least of our worries of that large group. That includes Louisville, Notre Dame, Florida State, Clemson. So you look at that group and then see that USF is the least. That's terrifying for one. But it also means, you know, this is the only path to 6 wins. We talk all the time about how Syracuse football, almost every single year without fail, is going to win 4 and lose 4. And then the season is dictated by what happens in those middle 4 games. If you decide to schedule in 3 losses in the non-conference, it's going to be almost impossible for you to make a bowl most years because you're going to have to go 3-1 against the odds. In those middle 4 games. Those middle 4 games are almost always going to be some combination of NC State, Boston College, Wake Forest, and then flex on probably whatever the Coastal team is, depending on the year, and depending on who we decide to schedule in the non-conference. So right now, you know, if you look at how difficult the schedule is, you look at us having 5 pretty solid losses penciled in, you've now got to find a way to go, you know, 6-1 in the other 7, and the odds just are rarely in your favor to do that.
Yes, if there is anything that I hope drastically changes as we move forward as a football program and an athletic department, and we harp on it all the time, it truly is the scheduling practices. And like, even... this, like, you outlined the reasons why the USF series is bad, and they are hard to argue at this point, especially because, you know, the minute that, like, literally the minute Syracuse landed at South Florida, they're like, all right, we're good again, like, because they weren't, like, the week before we played them last year. They were pretty bad, right, and they all of a sudden became good. And when you are a South Florida, or a quote, South Florida, unquote, program, you can do that in a hurry, unlike a team like UConn, which, you know, who knows if Bob Diaco sticks around long enough to see it all the way through, but they beat Houston last year, so there is some hope there.
Was it Ward out for that game?
I don't remember. I think he might have been. Well, yeah, because they're like undefeated. Yeah, no, he definitely was, because he has the longest active winning streak of any quarterback in FBS, I believe. So, yeah, like, that's very sound. But, like, conceptually, I do like the idea of playing a Florida team in Florida every year. And I know that scheduling FAU and FIU are probably not the easiest thing because everyone would love to schedule FAU and FIU.
But let's do that.
Yeah, but let's try to do that. Maybe pay them a little more money. We'll find it. Like, and hopefully, you know, Wild Hack and Babers, that dream team, knows, you know, understands this and is willing to do things like that versus playing USF and even UCF. Like, I know they were awful last year, but that was kind of unprecedented. You couldn't have really predicted that, them being as bad as they were, and I wouldn't bet on them being that bad for that long. So, yeah. Playing games in Florida and versus Florida schools is good. Let's just make them the right ones, and let's just do it the years where we're, you know, not already going to Florida State or Miami, you know, once every 35 years based on our current division arrangement.
I agree. And I've also said this, too. You know, like, the equation right now is going to be different than what the equation will end up being when they vote in October. I really hate the 8+2 model. I don't like the 9+1 either. I just think it doesn't behoove the ACC, and we've talked about this, we're not going to like dive down this rabbit hole again, but it doesn't behoove the ACC to eliminate bowl shares and teams that are playing for the postseason. Long term, your growth is going to be dictated by how many teams you can get to the postseason. I mean, the SEC thrives on the fact that it can put 10 or 11 schools every year into bowls because it schedules advantageously. And every school seems to understand, by and large, you know, what its station is in life, because the SEC kind of agrees as a group that they're not going to schedule too far out except for some marquee games for only the marquee schools. I mean, when I did that article a couple months ago that talked about, you know, which schools scheduled out the furthest or which failed to, most of the top of that list were SEC schools because those schools are looking to feel out, you know, I think other than maybe Vandy, I guess Mississippi State perhaps, and a couple others, maybe Kentucky, I guess. Like, every SEC school is a year away from potentially contending for a championship. So, you know, they want to kind of feel out where they are. They want to get a gauge on what the roster looks like. I think that would be a better model for all of college football, really. I don't like having to lock up a schedule 10 years out like some schools have and continue to, because then it makes our situation, which has the potential to look competitive and smart because we're gauging where we are and then scheduling accordingly, that only works if every other school is doing the same thing. If every other school isn't, then what you're left with is you have to play whoever is available, and a lot of times that's a good school from the SEC because they're the only other conference scheduling like this.
Yeah, I mean, I think, like you said, college football scheduling in general is, like, pretty out of whack. Unfortunately, it's, like, kind of the game that Syracuse is forced into playing. But the more that, you know, conferences move towards having, you know, specific rules for who you have to schedule and how many power teams and whatnot, there's just going to be a real crush on scheduling these schools that do have advantages to playing, like a FAU or FIU. So, obviously, it stinks that, you know, it's going to be more competitive to schedule those kind of schools, but it's still not an excuse to not, like, be out on top of things and do things as well as possible. And Syracuse has just put itself in such a hole based on, you know, its inability to have any kind of sense of urgency in these scheduling practices. So hopefully that changes. We haven't really seen it yet, but obviously it's still early in both our coaching tenure and our AD's tenure. So I hold out hope.
Completely agree. So predictions time, Dan. I know we both kind of painted a dour picture. What kind of score would you go with? And then, I guess, let me know if you feel like you'd be content with it.
I'm going to go USF 42, Syracuse 31. I just made that up in my head. I have no, I didn't crunch the numbers on anything. Would I accept it? I mean, at this point, like, I feel like I'm really out on, like, trying to, like, if the bowl thing happens and if we get farther in the season and bowls look Like, if we're playing for a sixth win in week 12, then I'll be, like, very into that. But, like, right now, I'm still very much about, like, the process here and seeing the offense play. Now, that really changes, like, if we do beat USF, which is definitely on the table. Like, it's not Louisville. It's not – Lamar Jackson isn't showing up. I think there is a fair drop-off there. Then I think we reset expectations again or adjust expectations. But until then, like, I really just want to see entertaining football. I want to see the vision more, even more clearly established, and we'll go from there. But yeah, I think USF will win this game. It'll definitely be closer than last weekend. But, you know, it would be, a mild upset of Syracuse to win, but it wouldn't be like the craziest thing. So be nice if they pull it off, but we'll see where we go.
Yeah, we're 14.5 point dogs now. I actually
Love Syracuse with the points there. It's just like high score, yeah, home dog. You're getting a home dog, and you're getting high scoring game. Like, I don't see USF winning by 15 points. It could happen, but like I think the smart bet is Syracuse plus 14.5 for sure.
I'm gonna play it close to the vest though on that line. I'm gonna go 48-34 USF wins. So with that, you're sweating it out till the end if you play that bet.
Little backdoor, like Eric Dungy to Editawo touchdown with 3.5 minutes left?
Nah, to be honest, I'm feeling SU actually hanging around in this one, and then USF just being able to kind of hang on. Like, I don't think Syracuse will look like they're really bringing the heat necessarily, but I think SU will probably be able to stay within 10 or so for much of the game. It'll always look like it's out of reach, but never enough that you're going to quit. So again, entertaining game. I'll take a between 10 and 14 point loss. That's not a problem. I would take a 24 point loss to USF and not really get like super bummed about it, just because of how much talent we know is on the roster. The one thing I will mention, however, I know you said if we're playing for a win in week 12 to get to 6, week 12 is Florida State, so we're not playing for a win there.
No, we're going to beat the Noles for sure. Definitely.
And we have week 13 against Pitt. So to me,
I think I meant game 13. And I mean, game 12, week 13, whatever.
I know. I'm joking. If we're not 6-4 heading into the Florida State game, we're not making a bowl.
Probably right. Unless, probably not. Pitt's pretty good.
really good?
Well, we'll see. I'm not going to turn it to really good, but if they beat Oklahoma State at Oklahoma State this weekend, especially, I mean, I guess Oklahoma State could go into like an emotional tank after how they lost last weekend.
They certainly are. That stupid bitching article that they wrote in their student paper that Deadspin posted.
Yeah, I mean, look, it sucks for them. They should have won the game. Like, the rule was very cut and dry. If that happened in Bedlam, like, you were not giving that game back. And I know it's, just shut up.
Yeah, and to be honest, I love the play, because I was sitting there talking to my wife and said Central Michigan's going to win this game on this stupid effing play, and then it happened, and like everybody else, I was just laughing my ass off.
Oh, the play was amazing. I think it was all worth it, because the play was so good.
And like, the thing is, it happened before. The exact same play happened a couple of years ago in the Bahamas Bowl with Central Michigan, with the same exact players involved. The issue I have, and I know they talked about it on Every Day Should Be Saturday. They talked about it, Shut Down Fullcast. They talked about it on Podcasting Played Nobody and a lot of other corners of the internet, is that this wasn't like the Miami Duke thing where a whistle should have blown or whatever. This play never should have occurred. And it's hard for me, as much as I laughed at the result and thought it was amazing, it's hard for me to see how you couldn't say that play didn't happen because it shouldn't have happened, and now the game and the game ended. I mean, Oklahoma State, if they were smart, really just should have punted. You go max protect, you put it in the back of the end zone, and there's your 4 seconds. But they didn't. They put the game within reach for Central Michigan and allowed the refs to, yes, they should have done their job correctly, but allowed the refs to put Central Michigan in a position to win as well. And they kind of got what they got. But I could understand the consternation around a play that never should have occurred, tacked on to the end of a game that was already over, winning a game. Especially when it was against the rules for it to occur.
Yeah, no, it was for sure the wrong call. Like, there's really no arguing that. But, A, Oklahoma State kind of got bailed out by the same refs in their final touchdown, right. And B, throwing an incomplete pass to try to end the game is like the dumbest thing they could have done.
Easily.
Yeah, there were 4 seconds left.
Just run around the backfield.
Either run around the backfield and kill as much time as possible and then pooch punt or just do anything else. Like, literally, like, that was just not – that was just a bad play. It was a bad play overall. It doesn't mean they should have lost based on something that's clearly not the rule. If you think about it for, like, a second after it happens, you're like, oh, yeah, that was wrong. I also don't know that I would trade that awesome Hail Mary. So
no.
For a team I don't care at all about, like Oklahoma State, I feel nothing about Oklahoma State. They draw
not either of these teams.
They're like literally one of the Power Five teams I am the most neutral on. I'm kind of cool that it happened, even though it was clearly bullshit. I think both of those thoughts can coexist in my mind, and I don't feel at all bad about that.
Fair enough. I think that's a good place to end it. It was a lively discussion today, Dan.
Oh yes, always.
Any parting thoughts?
Tulane, we got it.
Tulane.
I don't know who they even play this week, but they're in the podcast now.
Let's figure out who they play. Might as well.
Yeah, I mean we're just over an hour, but you know it's not too bad for us.
It's okay. I didn't want the Tulane class schedule. I wanted the Tulane football schedule. Come on, Google. Navy. This is actually gonna be a fun game.
Some lot of option. What percentage of plays run in this game are going to be option plays?
89%.
I haven't actually watched Tulane yet this year. Are they like running? Is it pretty much the same as the Georgia Southern offense?
Yes and no. Admittedly, like I watched some of the Wake Forest game, and I really didn't love it. And then they faced Southern last week. So
no one loved that. That game's mother didn't love it. Like, it was 7-3. yeah. Oh god.
Fine. I think this game might be fun. It's on ESPN3 though, so let's see if I actually get to watch it. If it gets any local pickup, broadcast wise, I'll have it. But yeah, I do try to get my Tulane fix and. Navy's entertaining enough, even without Kevin Keenan Reynolds. So I feel like around the 4 o'clock Pacific or the 4 o'clock Eastern. I think. Oh no, Pacific time. Okay, so it's a 7 o'clock game, which means no one's going to be watching this, which means that's right up my alley. Perfect. Anyway, Dan, as always, it was a pleasure.
Yes, very excited for another. This actually should be a great weekend of college football, so very, very excited for that.
Yeah, this week's schedule is lit after last week's schedule was not, but the results were.
Yeah, I was not surprised that last weekend was like not the worst. It generally, that is how it plays out. There's always one week that like, oh, this sucks. And it wasn't like a great weekend of college football, but it was definitely like there was pretty much a good game happening at any given moment, including Arizona State and Texas Tech literally filling every possible thought of what that game could possibly be. Except Tech was a pretty big favorite and got their doors bashed in by the running back, Kalen Ballage? Ballage?
That sounds right. I think it's
Ballage. He had 8 touchdowns. Yeah, incredible. Yeah.
And on that note, again, Dan, thanks for showing up. And everybody, be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, and go Orange this weekend.
Go Orange.